From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, what will happen if President Donald Trump fires Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller? Texas activists are planning and preparing. And new numbers for Texas maternal mortality are released. Was it an exaggerated problem, or is there something else going on? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. President Donald Trump is showing signs that he is growing impatient with the investigation of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller into Russia's interference with the 2016 presidential election. The raids this week on the office and hotel room of Trump's longtime personal lawyer and fixer, Michael D. Cohen, is the latest move that seemed to have triggered inflamed tweets from the president. And there's been a chorus of Trump supporters on cable TV calling for the firing of Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who signed off on those raids. The firing of Rosenstein would be a way to set up the shutting down of the Mueller investigation, and it would create a constitutional crisis that would test the powers of the presidency and establish if the executive branch is unaccountable. Some say this would give the president unchecked powers and fundamentally change America's democracy. Activists in Texas and across the nation are preparing for this possibility. Ben Wickler is an organizer for MoveOn.org.
If Mueller is fired, or if Rod Rosenstein is fired, or if Trump starts issuing blanket pardons to people involved in the Russia investigation and the cover-up, people are ready to take to the streets in every major city in America, including across Texas. More than 300,000 people have already RSVP'd for protests. It'll happen on the same day as the firing if it happens before 2 p.m. or the next day at noon if it happens later in the afternoon or the evening. The country is ready to go.
What does that mean, ready to go?
If Trump attacks the Constitution and the rule of law by trying to shut down the investigation into him and his campaign, it needs to turn from a constitutional crisis into a political crisis. So the strategy organized by Move On and Indivisible and Public Citizen and dozens of other groups is to make sure that there are protests in public, in the streets, right away, that will kind of kick off a process of making sure that everyone in Congress knows that their jobs and their political careers are on the line in how they respond.
So will these protests, will there be an emphasis on keeping things peaceful, or how do you think these protests would be rolled out?
These will be peaceful protests. The guidance we've been providing to all the organizers, even the RSVP form on the page, on the web pages for these protests, involve a commitment to keeping it lawful, nonviolent, peaceful. We are training the organizers in de-escalation tactics in case people do try to, you know, get out of hand. The whole goal is to make clear that the public stands on the side of the rule of law, and the president's lawlessness is something that has to be brought to heel by the Article I, first branch of the government, the legislative branch.
Now, do you have a list of demands, or have these been crafted? What would you all be demanding?
So in the event of a Trump-sparked constitutional crisis, we have three demands for Congress. The first is that they move immediately to ensure that all of the papers and materials collected by the investigation are preserved rather than destroyed. The second thing is that the House needs to start obstruction of justice hearings right away, which could turn into impeachment hearings. In the Senate, the demand is for a Watergate-style select committee to be appointed that can hire investigators, maybe hire the same investigators that were just shut down by Trump, and immediately resume the search to get to the bottom of this. Essentially, if the executive branch undermines its own ability to hold itself to account through an independent investigation, then that responsibility falls squarely on the legislative branch. And this is a set of demands that we can keep pressing until there are leaders in place who are willing to do the right thing if the current ones aren't.
President Trump has been creating a narrative that the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, is acting outside of what is proper, and that he is basically being prosecuted, being investigated because he won the election, not because he did anything improper or illegal.
Donald Trump loves to spin fantasy worlds, but we have actual laws in this country. They are passed by Congress, they're written down, they're enforced by our judicial system. And we already know that a whole bunch of people right around Donald Trump have broken those laws. We have guilty pleas. We have I think 19 people have been indicted so far. So there's no question that there's criminality here. And whatever Donald Trump says really doesn't matter. What counts is what he's actually done and what he's going to do and whether the public will demand accountability for it.
How do people know that MoveOn.org, your organization that is preparing for this type of activity, if there are firings of the special prosecutor, that this is not a political action by the Democrats in order to regain control?
You know, if you look at polling or focus groups or what bubbles up in town halls all across the country, the number one issue in this election has been and remains health care. That's the thing that the most people have been active on, fighting against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And frankly, if there were no investigation, this would be a landslide on healthcare itself. I think it's, some charge that this Russia investigation stuff is a distraction from the kind of bread and butter issues that affect people's lives. And I think, I understand that argument. This is about a threat to the Constitution. It's not a political strategy. This is about the question of whether the United States will continue to be the constitutional republic that was set up, with all its flaws at the time of the founding, or whether we're going to slide in the direction of a Venezuela or a Hungary. This is a question of whether the government is actually governed by the rule of law. And that's something that people of all political stripes need to stand up for right now. I'm in touch regularly with people across the political spectrum that are gravely concerned about this. And I think at the rallies and marches, you're going to see speakers not only from the progressive movement of the resistance, but Republicans and independents and law enforcement people and people representing all different walks of American life who think that the Constitution, the oath to the Constitution, is more important than any party loyalty or allegiance to one person.
The last time there was a mass action like this in America was the Occupy movement, which was a colossal failure and basically an embarrassment because of the inability for Occupy to actually define what it wanted and how to, and the refusal to get involved in the political process. Have y'all actually learned lessons from what went wrong with Occupy?
A lot of people involved in the Occupy movement really saw it as something different than a protest movement to achieve a political or legislative goal. There was, a lot of conversations with those folks where they didn't want to issue a list of legislative demands because that wasn't their project. This is something very different. This is an organized movement that is focused on achieving a constitutional outcome within the system that we've got. It's about protecting the fundamental institutions of American life and of our constitutional democracy or of our republic. I think the thing that you can see from Occupy is that when the moment is right, tons of people can get involved in taking action at the same time. And we've now seen that with the Women's March and the March for Our Lives and many other times as well. In this case, the demand is crystal clear. It is morally urgent. And it's something that with enough political pressure, we'll be able to win.
We've seen these marches before. Like you said, we had the Women's March and the March for Our Lives, which has been the really huge, big turnouts, some of the biggest marches that we've seen in American history. And yet the march in and of itself changes nothing. We still see suspicious candidates being put forth by the Trump administration for high judicial appointments. We still see votes being taken in the legislature that would be that are not influenced by these marches. So you're going to have a big march today that Trump fires, if he does fire Mueller or anyone else. What would that do?
The immediate thing that a march can do is force legislators to answer questions about their positions. And we saw with the March for Our Lives and the lead up to it, senators like Marco Rubio speaking about gun issues in a way that they never had before. We saw the Florida legislature pass a law that would have been unthinkable just a couple of months before. So we're seeing some movement on the ground, and we'll really see in November what happens with the millions of young people that were politicized and pulled into the process by that moment. In the case of this potential constitutional crisis, there are a lot of Republicans who've said publicly and many more who've said privately that if we reach a crisis point, they will be there. They won't be silent. And what this march does is it calls that question. It says to them, your constituents right now are demanding a response. Every journalist who's talking to a senator or a member of Congress in the wake of a firing is going to ask them what they're willing to do. And as long as there are protesters who are keeping this front and center in the news, those members of Congress will face that question over and over and over.
Do you think that this planning and preparing could be a deterrent so that the people in administration are aware this is not going to go unnoticed?
I hope that all the organizing that so many people are doing, all the preparation, is noticed by the political prognosticators within the Republican Party and within the Trump administration. I hope that Republicans who are concerned about the reelection are noticing that there are multiple protests planned within their districts and are calling the White House and urging them not to do this. You saw Grassley say that it would be political suicide to fire Mueller. I think that those kinds of statements are probably informed by the knowledge that in every state in the country, there are big protests planned that senators and members of Congress are going to have to answer to.
You think it's going to happen? You think he's going to fire him?
I learned on a dark day in November 2016 to stop making predictions about American politics. I just want to be ready for anything.
Ben Wickler is an organizer for MoveOn.org. They are preparing for the possibility that President Trump would try to fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller or Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein or issue a blanket set of presidential pardons. For the past few years, the Texas maternal mortality rate was seen as so high that it was unbelievable. Turns out, according to a study released this week, it was indeed not believable. This week, the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force released a study that found that the maternal mortality figures from 2012, which had Texas mothers dying at rates that shocked experts and the public, it was all based on sloppy and erroneous data collection. But who's at fault for that? And what's being done to fix it? And what does this mean, that there is no maternal mortality crisis in Texas? Well, not so fast. Sophie Novak is covering this issue for the Texas Observer.
In 2016, there was a study released that found that the maternal mortality rate in Texas had doubled in a two-year period. And no one could really explain why that happened. And that, you know, generated a lot of headlines about how Texas has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world. And folks were kind of looking into that, trying to figure out what could be going on. On Monday, a new study was released by researchers in Texas that found that actually those numbers weren't quite the case. They had confirmed some of those death certificates with other medical records and found that the number that they originally thought for 2012 was actually less than half that amount, which, you know, of course, is good news if it's fewer women that are dying of pregnancy-related causes than we thought. But there are also a lot of folks, lawmakers and advocates here, that are concerned that these new numbers will be used by state officials to say there's not actually that much of a problem here anymore, and that's really not the case. There still is a maternal mortality problem in Texas, and it actually, the study raises another problem that's bigger than we thought, which is that we have a pretty significant data problem as far as maternal mortality here goes.
When they looked at the death certificates, they turned out, what, they didn't die? Or what did they find?
It turns out a lot of that discrepancy was due to folks in Texas who had been filling out those death certificates, which typically are doctors, coroners, had mistakenly checked that women were pregnant either at that time or recently when in fact they weren't. That's what most of those data errors are being attributed to. I'll also say that another pretty significant difference is that in this new study, this state of Texas is looking only at maternal deaths that occurred during pregnancy or up to 42 days after. And they're doing that to compare it, you know, with an earlier study from 2016. But the issue there is that state researchers have in the past said that we really should be looking at maternal deaths that occur up to a year after the pregnancy has after birth or after the pregnancy has terminated. And so by only narrowing that window to 42 days after, this new study is really leaving out a lot of women and a lot of maternal deaths that actually these state researchers have already confirmed.
Now, the death certificate part of it, not only is it just doctors and medical examiners who are filling out death certificates, but it's also in many parts of Texas, it's JPs, Justices of the Peace. And these are
That's
elected
right.
officials. and they're not medical professionals. And their lack of knowledge in dealing with death certificates not only is impacting the data that we're having in this area with maternal mortality, but also in the opioid count, how many people are dying from opioid addiction and overdosing. And so this seems to be a problem that has a lot of impact across the state in trying to figure out what is happening in critical areas.
It does, definitely. And it also has a lot of impact nationally as well. Problems with maternal mortality data is a big problem across the United States. It's notoriously bad, inconsistent, filled with errors. The U.S. hasn't released an official maternal mortality rate nationwide since 2007. There just hasn't been the kind of investment in this issue that there needs to be. And so this study and kind of finding all of these errors with Texas's data in terms of these death certificates, also, you know, the researchers hope could shine a light in some other states as well, because right now the data is just kind of all over the place.
And that window in which we're going to include a death or not in the maternal mortality as a factor is critical, because if it's just going to be a matter of months or if it's going to be a full year, we know that there is an issue of postnatal care, postpartum depression hitting a lot of women, and that is a factor. It drives some women to engage in risky behavior like alcohol and drugs, which is a factor in this also.
That's right, and that's a really important point. And the reason, you know, part of the reason that time frame matters so much is that in Texas, pregnant women are eligible for Medicaid coverage that continues for only 60 days after they give birth, and then they lose that insurance coverage. And so we know that Texas is, you know, notoriously bad on women's health. We have the highest uninsured rate in the nation. Generally, one in three women don't have access to care ahead of pregnancy. You know, we're the top of a lot of those charts. And losing the health coverage just 60 days after birth, you know, one of the state task force's main recommendations in terms of addressing this maternal mortality problem in Texas was to extend that Medicaid coverage a year after birth. And that's largely because state researchers found that a lot of these deaths were occurring after that 60-day mark.
So the cynic out there is going to ask, are these numbers, are they being juked in order to satisfy a political climate? Is this happening? And you say, okay, problem solved. We don't have the high maternal mortality rate that we had before because we're changing the yardstick.
I'm not going to speak to any motivations, but there are certainly folks out there that are very concerned about that. And I think you can see that a little bit in the way that some state officials have been talking about this new study. Governor Greg Abbott tweeted after it came out, he said, turns out the Texas maternal mortality rate spike scare was grossly exaggerated. It was actually far less than the exaggerated report. And really what the issue here is that the state's own data is deeply flawed. It's not, you know, that some other study had inflated those numbers. So really this emphasizes the problem that there is still in this state. And there are definitely, you know, folks that are concerned that state officials will use these new numbers in a way to kind of diminish what the problem is.
It's still a major problem among African American women.
That's right. This new report and the state's earlier report both found that African American women are disproportionately dying at much higher rates.
For many people, even before 2016 and even before that report came out, there was attention being paid to maternal mortality in Texas. Even if we look at the numbers with these new parameters, it's still bad.
Right, exactly. And I mean, this new methodology makes it difficult to kind of compare apples to apples in terms of how Texas fits in with other states. Just because other states aren't using this same kind of confirmation methodology, and also because, you know, it's important to remember that this new study is only on 1 year. It's only looking at deaths in 2012, and so we really don't have a sense of the scope of the issue for other years or really how Texas fits in so well. But we do know that most of these maternal deaths are preventable. And so we had, you know, Lisa Ollier, who is the chair of the state's task force, on, and one of the co-authors of this new study, told the Houston Chronicle this week, saying, you know, we can't lose momentum on this. This still is a major problem, both in terms of maternal mortality and also in terms of severe maternal complications that might not end in death, but might be still very serious and concerning.
But when you talk to the experts and you ask them what needs to be done in order to deal with the maternal mortality rate that Texas has, even though it wasn't as high as we first thought, it's still severe and it's still something that, I mean, every woman in the state deserves to be able to go in and have a childbirth as healthy as possible. But when you talk to experts and you say, what's the solution? They tell you we have to look upstream. We have to look at a lifelong health practices, providing health care to women and help them be healthy throughout their lives, because it's not just when you're pregnant that this becomes an issue. It seems like there are some people in Texas who don't want to do that, and they're very relieved by these new numbers.
That's right. The bottom line here is that the way to address this kind of problem is to expand access to health care for women before and after pregnancy. That's what, you know, all the experts say. That includes the state researchers that are on the Texas Maternal Mortality Task Force. Their top recommendation in their report that they released in 2016 was expanding access to care, you know, at least for women up to a year after pregnancy, at least. And that's something that, you know, they recommended in their report 2 years ago, and the legislature hasn't acted on. And there were several bills up last session that would do just that, that would expand access to care at least a year after after birth, and those did not receive a committee hearing. And we've been kind of punting action on that in favor of, you know, extending research on this issue, which is clearly also very important given how serious these data errors are. But if you talk to any of the folks that are working on this issue, they'll say that the, you know, the main way to address this problem is to expand access to health care for women.
Sophie Novak is a staff reporter for the Texas Observer. You can read her reporting and coverage of the maternal mortality issue at texasobserver.org. There are more than 40 million people in the United States who depend on food stamps, but the farm bill that's now being proposed by Republicans who control Congress would set in sweeping new work mandates. The SNAP program would require able-bodied Americans aged 18 to 59 to work or participate in job training for 20 hours a week. Celia Cole is the CEO of Feeding Texas.
We're very concerned that it's going to cut needy Texans off the program, that children are going to lose benefits, hunger is going to go up, and it's going to put new strain on our food banks, and it's going to be really impossible for them to keep up with the increase in demand as a result of those cuts.
Well, what are the restrictions? What's happening? What's in it?
Well, it's making a couple of big changes. One, it's taking away flexibility that states were given decades ago to sort of conform rules in their SNAP programs with their cash assistance programs. And so in taking away that flexibility, which they call broad-based categorical eligibility, it's going to lead to people who are on the program via those rules getting cut off. And that includes working families and families with children. It's important to remember SNAP's a household benefit. So even if you take benefits away from just one member of the household, like an adult, the overall resources for that family goes down and kids go hungry. And it also imposes time limits on adults with kids on how long they can be on the program without working. And that's going to lead to people getting cut off the program when they can't find steady work, when they have struggled to either find a job or to keep it. And, you know, hunger never helped anyone find a job. So we think that change is really counterproductive. But, you know, in balance, it's going to, anytime you take food assistance away from someone who needs it. Again, their needs don't go away. It just makes it that much harder for that family to make ends meet.
There already is a work requirement for SNAP benefits. Now it's just getting tougher. But does this kind of change SNAP entirely from a program that helps people that can't find work to a program that helps people who do work? But we should be asking, why do people who work need SNAP?
Right. I mean, I think that you nailed it there. You know, SNAP was built from the ground up to be an anti-hunger program. It's not a work program. Certainly, we can help people when they're unemployed or underemployed and need SNAP by giving them access to jobs, job training, and helping them find work. But the bottom line is people on SNAP want to work. They're just struggling to find work in a labor market that simply isn't producing the kind of jobs that pay enough money so people can make ends meet, or they don't have the right skills for the jobs that are out there. And, you know, low-wage work is not consistent. You don't get consistent hours. The pay isn't enough to get people off of SNAP. So, you know, I think we need a course correction in our economy. We need a course correction in our labor market. But there's nothing wrong with SNAP. We do not need a stiff course in SNAP. It's a strong program. It works well. And it helps people when the labor market or our economy fails them.
So under the current law, able-bodied adults without dependents between the ages of 18 and 49 are required to work or to be in a job training in order to qualify for SNAP benefits. And one of the changes in the new proposed law is that it would raise that 49 to, what is it, 55? So it raises that requirement, the age.
Right. It changes the age from 18 to 59, but it also imposes those time limits, if you're not working the right number of hours, on families, on adults with children over the age of 6. And prior to this bill, it was only able-bodied adults without dependents that were that faced time limits. So now you're saying to families with kids, if you can't find a job that gives you 20 hours a week consistently, you're cut off, and you potentially could be cut off for up to 12 months the first time, you know, you don't meet the requirement if you can't find that steady work.
Right, but I want to focus on this one little, I mean, there's a lot in here, and so
yeah,
I think by breaking it down, you kind of get a better idea of how this is going to impact individuals. So you could have
right.
a person who has worked their entire life, and they lose their job at 53 years old, and you know
right.
how hard it is to, if you don't have the job skills, that now you lose your job at 53, and
mm-hmm.
now you're out on the streets, and
mm-hmm.
you need support, and you've been paying into the system, and you've been playing by the rules and working hard your entire life, and this program is not going to help you out unless
right.
you...
Right, it's not going to be there for you unless you can find a way to get yourself back into the workforce at a time, you know, in your life where it's hard. So it's taking, you know, food assistance away, you're right, from seniors who have worked hard their whole lives and paid into the system, and they deserve to be able to take back out of the system when they need it. And this bill is making it hard for people to do that.
Celia Cole is the CEO of Feeding Texas. She says the proposed farm bill would take SNAP benefits from Texans who depend on this anti-hunger program. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.